Introductions as people walk in, and I'm just going to encourage some of those folks who are sitting in the individual chairs in the back to come on and walk forward to the tables and join us. We'd love to have you up here. So we're going to end with two keynotes on how can we reach our goals. It's a great pleasure to introduce them. Fernando Reimers is Ford Foundation Professor of International Education and Director of Global Education and of the International Education Policy at Harvard University. He chaired a global education think tank as part of the Harvard Advanced Leadership Initiative, which convened global education leaders to discuss reinventing education in the 21st century. He's advisor to a cross-national study of democratic citizenship skills and civic education in Latin America, which is particularly exciting to us because those who know our conference series know that we actually do it on a major equity theme each year, but it changes each year, and next year's theme is on civic participation, so we're delighted with that connection. More than that, though, I think Fernando has built this phenomenal training program at Harvard, which is training people who are leading education programs around the world, and not only training them on locale, but now with distance learning, really reaching out into the community and having an enormous impact that way. Bob Prouty is acting manager of the Education for All Fast Track Initiative, a partnership of donors, developing countries, and civil society groups whose purpose is to accelerate progress towards the 2015 Millennium Development Goal. The EFA FTI has allocated $1.4 billion in support through its catalytic fund. It's hard to think of a larger initiative. And I know that I'd say a particular great compliment, we had one of the very busy people among many of you who have incredibly crowded calendars who decided to come, and we're grateful you did, and they looked and they saw that Bob was going to be here and they said they had to be here. So it's a great pleasure to introduce you both and to turn it over to you.
Thank you very much, Jody. Good afternoon. I really appreciate the invitation to be with you today to discuss the relationship between research and action in advancing educational opportunity globally. The title of our session is deceptively simple. How do we know what works to promote educational equity? This is a title that invites us to reflect on the relationship between knowledge and action. How is knowledge useful to action? What knowledge is useful to act? How do we generate that knowledge, and how do we use it? Allow me for a moment to digress, asking four different questions. How do we know that flossing our teeth increases the health of our gums? How do we know that if we open a parachute in midair, it will slow down our free fall from an airplane and maybe even help us avoid a fatal crash upon landing? How do we know that investing our savings in stocks is better than keeping them under a mattress? And how do we know that political leaders elected democratically do a better job for their constituents than unelected leaders? These questions underscore three points. The first, that all knowledge about our ability to predict future events based on our study of past events is limited, incomplete, and provisional, and that we can only make predictions about the future based on multiple assumptions about the regularities of the systems that we are studying. The second point these questions illustrate is that all knowledge about the probability that an action will be followed by a result is subject to assumptions about the constancy of other conditions that can also influence those results. So we know that the frequency of dental flossing contributes to healthier gums, all other things being equal, an assumption whose actual probability is often difficult to estimate. These examples also illustrate that in some systems, the proportion of variation explained by our models is greater than in other systems. Our knowledge about how our gums respond to dental flossing is more robust than our knowledge of how CEOs or mutual fund managers work to maximize return for investors, or of how elected public officials act to advance the interests of those who elect them. And yet, imperfect as this knowledge is, most of us would agree that it is sufficient to lead us to floss our teeth, to use parachutes when jumping off a plane, to invest our savings rather than stash them under a mattress, and to prefer democracy to autocracy, at least most of the times when we have a choice about the matter, and when we're not distracted by other events. In those preferences, we demonstrate a willingness to act based on imperfect knowledge, in the same way that the traveling salesman who tries to figure out the most efficient route to visit a number of cities is better off starting his journey with incomplete knowledge than waiting forever to compute the perfect algorithm. As you recall, in this classical mathematical problem, a salesman is given a list of cities and their pairwise distances and has the goal of finding the shortest possible tour that visits each city exactly once. Finding an exact solution to this problem is too time-consuming, and the complexity of this problem increases exponentially with each additional city in the itinerary. So the traveling salesman is better off just getting on with his journey with imperfect knowledge, bounded rationality. The limitations of the knowledge base that undergird each of these examples stem not from the particular approaches used to generate that knowledge, but from the complexity of those systems themselves. We are likely to stick to parachutes over the alternatives, even though no one has yet done an experimental study of their effectiveness. We're likely to stick to stocks and mutual funds over mattresses, in spite of some experimental evidence showing that some stock-picking monkeys can outperform markets or traders. And we're likely to stick to electing our leaders, even if some of them disappoint us, some of them lie, and a few use the privilege of their office to advance their private interests. I will now return from my digression to our discussion of using knowledge to advance educational opportunity, in the hope that the digression help us approach our conversation with both humility and pragmatism about the way in which knowledge can inform action, and with a recognition that it is in the nature of complex social systems that many actions are evidently not informed by knowledge about what works to achieve the intended purposes of those systems. With these limitations in mind, what knowledge, even if limited, is sufficient to help us act in expanding educational opportunity? The knowledge that permits us to create the instructional programs and to implement them on a large scale so that all children can develop competencies that help them become self-authoring individuals and caring and contributing members of their communities and societies. But here, too, we must, as the traveling salesman, be content with knowledge that is incomplete and imperfect. Our knowledge to predict the future individual or social value of particular competencies based on their present or past value is very limited indeed. We know that certain cognitive abilities are rewarded by particular sectors in the economy at particular times, and we know that specific knowledge can provide some individual advantages in terms of advancing one's health, preparing for further education and specific trades and professions, and material well-being. We know also that certain interpersonal skills and dispositions can facilitate the peaceful resolution of conflict. From these fragments of knowledge, we make leaps of inference on the value of investing sizable social resources to develop specific cognitive skills, literacy, numeracy, or scientific reasoning. Some of us claim that there is value in promoting the capacity for independent and critical reasoning, or in developing compassion and citizenship skills to actively participate in local or national politics, or in the capacity for moral reasoning to contribute to sustain a society governed by basic human rights and values, or in the capacity to understand the environmental consequences of our actions in order to create more ecologically sustainable forms of human-environmental interaction. We make even further leaps of inference when we invest most of these resources in these specialized institutions of relatively recent invention we call schools. The necessary evidence to support these claims, to test this hypothesis adequately, is very difficult to obtain, just as it is not practical to conduct experiments on the effectiveness of parachutes. In addition, the knowledge that certain actions can cause certain effects, all other things being equal, is insufficient to help us predict the consequences of actions in a world where the other conditions that need to be equal often are not. So a quality education increases the probability that people can find jobs when those jobs exist, but the creation of jobs is not the product of the education system. Providing girls and women with a quality education prepares them to be self-authoring individuals, but does not by itself change the social norms that govern the extent to which women are allowed to be self-authoring. The knowledge that is helpful to advance social equity clearly needs to be robust in terms of external validity, of being applicable to the real world in all its complexity, as well as in terms of internal validity. Furthermore, the knowledge that is helpful to advance social equity needs to be relevant to addressing social equity challenges as they exist in the world. Knowledge about how to improve the quality of tertiary education in societies where only a small percentage of the population has access to this level of education will be of limited use to address equity gaps unless it focuses specifically in how to get universities to work on those who do not have access to them or to include them. Our knowledge of the social value of various competencies is insufficient to help us discern the long-term effects of emphasizing math and science over humanities or liberal arts, of technical knowledge over ethical reasoning, or of formal education over entrepreneurship training through non-formal programs. Historical knowledge teaches us to be prudent in making assumptions about the special virtue of highly schooled individuals. The Nuremberg trials remind us that people with multiple doctorates were incapable of understanding that simply following the law can, in some cases, lead to deeply unethical actions. Again, in seeking to balance various purposes of education, some of us argue for an education that promotes academic excellence as well as character and citizenship skill development. But the reason for this preference is not based on empirical evidence, but on normative reasoning. Recognizing the importance of addressing the relevance of education in seeking to improve its quality, and understanding that questions of relevance are necessarily situated in place and time, is helpful to place our discussion of how knowledge can guide action in advancing educational opportunity squarely in the middle of a process that is bound by political deliberation about purposes. Research can and has been used in the past to obfuscate what are normative choices and should therefore, at least in democratic societies, be public and political deliberations. But researchers have no special claim or authority to determine what should be taught in schools and what specific competencies will make individuals or societies more free, capable of agency, or happier. Clearly, research-based knowledge cannot solve normative preferences, and in democratic societies, those are best sorted out in the deliberative process that is part of life in a democracy. What role can then research-based knowledge play in sustaining educational practices to advance equality of educational opportunity? The role of helping to inform the consideration of alternative ways to achieve education objectives, once those objectives and possibly trade-offs between objectives have been established through the political process. Research-based knowledge can also inform the political deliberations about education, making visible problems that may be out of the sight and mind of elites or of the most active participants in the political process. Education research can then help the process of agenda setting as well as policy and program design. Educational evaluation of programs and policies can further help advance the theories on which interventions are based to contribute to program improvement. This role for research recognizes that the establishment of education objectives is not a function of research, and that the creation and implementation of programs to advance educational opportunity requires the creation, design, and invention of educational programs as much as research and evaluation of those programs. These programs, in turn, must first of all be relevant to addressing the challenges of equity. The answer to the question of what works, then, must go beyond research to integrate research results and theory into the creation and design of practical and scalable approaches to helping students learn, approaches that focus particularly on serving those students who are currently most excluded from the opportunities to develop the competencies that enable them to be self-authoring individuals. There is a growing body of science about learning and human development which is useful as a foundation to the engineering task of creating educational programs that can provide learning opportunities to excluded children and to all children. But the extension of this knowledge to inform educational practice is by no means direct and needs translation and adaptation. For example, about a century ago, Russian psychologist Lev Vygotsky developed the concept of zone of proximal development, which he defined as the difference between what a learner can do without help and what he or she can do with help. From this concept, Vygotsky derived the educational principle that education can best foster learning, providing children with experiences which are in their zone of proximal development. Many educators have used this principle to develop gradual and structured curricula, but the task of defining the scope and sequence of a curriculum is a task of invention and design, not a direct application of Vygotsky's principle. Similarly, there is a well-developed body of empirical knowledge on how people learn to read, called the science of reading. Contemporary research in this area includes the use of direct observations of brain functioning as it relates to various components of the process of reading and of learning to read. The knowledge derived from this basic research can contribute to the engineering task of designing literacy programs, but such task must go beyond the basic facts established by the science in creating complete instructional programs. For instance, The science of reading has established the value of simultaneously supporting the development of decoding skills, comprehension, and motivation to read. Translating this general principle into a specific program needs a process of creation that takes into account that reading materials are available in schools and to children more generally, what skills and knowledge teachers have about the process of literacy, what means do they have to evaluate literacy skills, how many students are taught by teachers in a classroom, and what support for literacy instruction is or can be made available outside the school. Once engineered, those programs can be evaluated rigorously, and those evaluations will contribute to refine the program theories in which those programs are based, and in so doing, advance the applied body of knowledge about literacy programming. What do we then need to know to promote educational equity, and how can research contribute to creating that knowledge? There are four broad areas where knowledge is essential to inform action in expanding educational opportunity. First, knowledge of the relationship of educational institutions to social institutions. Second, knowledge of how educational institutions function. Third, knowledge about the intended and unintended results of programs of instructional improvement. And fourth, knowledge about the contributions of leadership to educational innovation and reform. The knowledge in these four broad categories should include in-depth study of national and subnational education systems, historical research, ethnographic studies of schools, classrooms, students and communities, school effectiveness research, program evaluation, as well as comparative knowledge of these topics across countries. That is to say, the knowledge base to support effective education reform needs to be multidimensional and multi-methods, helping to inform a systemic view of educational institutions and of how they change. While this knowledge will be helpful to inform the design and innovation necessary to support action, such design will need to draw on other forms of knowledge and development. For example, the development of new telecommunication technologies, particularly cell phones, computers, and instantaneous translation technologies, offer much potential to engineer innovation to some education challenges, including administering educational institutions, as well as enriching pedagogy or supporting teacher professional development. Integrating such technology into sound programs requires that we go beyond the study of what has been. The continuous evolution of good applications of such technology would benefit, of course, from formative evaluation. So we need to know how educational institutions relate to other social institutions. This includes understanding how a society and various groups within the society value education, what the continuities and discontinuities are between how schools conduct their work, and the values, expectations, and norms of families and communities, and understanding what groups of the population participate in educational institutions and with what consequences for those who participate and those who don't. Understanding educational institutions includes also that we know what broad purposes they serve in addition to the stated purposes of educating children. For example, in some societies, public education systems are used to reward political loyalty and support political parties or groups. In some societies, educational institutions are one of the mechanisms through which various forms of segregation are practiced along socioeconomic, political, ethnic, racial, or religious divides. In some societies, different forms of bribes and gifts are extracted from students and parents for access to the best schools, teachers, or special attention from teachers. Knowledge about the pervasiveness of those practices and their consequences in sorting different students into different education streams or in excluding particular groups from education is essential to understand how educational institutions relate to other social institutions and to culture. It is essential to know what different groups in the society expect of schools and how satisfied they are with the way in which schools function at present. Knowing how to improve the educational efficacy or relevancy of schools serving disadvantaged children will be of limited use in societies where elected public officials have no incentives to support education reform because the electorate is generally satisfied with the way in which schools are working. So here is an example of the knowledge about the relationship of education to larger social institutions. In many parts of the developing world, a bulge in the young population has created a new set of social circumstances for youth and young adults, especially for males, who are neither in school nor working, and who in many ways find it challenging to conform to traditional norms of transition to adulthood. In some regions, this problem has been aggravated by schools and other social institutions who have shaped in the young the expectation of employment by government or in the formal sector of the economy, when those sectors do not have the capacity to employ all of those in this particular age group. There are understandable reasons for concern over the possibility that youth and young adults may become disaffected and engage in various forms of oppositional behavior that could have destabilizing effects in their societies. Understanding this demographic, economic, and social context is essential to understanding what purpose and modalities of education should serve. In some instances, the biggest equity challenges are about the young who are not included in the existing educational institutions. But it is not obvious that these challenges will be addressed by tinkering with the schools as they exist or in getting those schools to become better at achieving their intended purposes. When schools do not promote individual agency, entrepreneurship, and the creativity and flexibility to equip young people with the competencies to create their own jobs and perhaps jobs for others, and to engage their lives in constructive ways, the kind of knowledge that can support equity is knowledge that can allow the radical transformation of schools, or even knowledge that allows the design of non-formal programs of entrepreneurship education, citizenship education, coupled with access to credit and information, which may be a more relevant response to those circumstances than fixing the ineffective schools. Similarly, in context of conflict or post-conflict, education reform obviously should not be just about including kids in the very institutions that have contributed to those conflicts, but should address them. We also need to know how educational institutions function and what is learned in them, who teaches, in what way, with what technology, with what pedagogy, with what organization and governance, what is taught to what students, at what cost and who pays. We need to know what is the effectiveness of schools at developing cognitive, social, and emotional competencies. We need to know what learning environments are like, how students are treated by their peers, by teachers, by others in the school, how children engage with schools in the process of learning. One of the most significant developments of the last two decades has been the development of comparative systems of student assessment that have evaluated what students are actually learning. We often assume that educational inclusion is about providing students the opportunity to develop cognitive skills. But of course, the development of the human mind integrates cognitive, emotional, and social experiences. And it is hard for children to develop academic skills in contexts that are inhospitable, if not outright harmful. Yet, few countries take bullying or the use of physical or psychological violence against children in schools seriously. There is an unexamined epidemic of violence in schools that governments and development institutions are not talking about. We know from comparative studies that there is much bullying that teenagers experience in schools. And yet, in spite of this evidence, we often assume that the task of inclusion is about getting students to attend school and to give them incentives so that they do that. One can ask, what are the consequences of a conditional cash transfer program that brings to school girls who have dropped out maybe because they are experiencing sexual harassment or other forms of violence in their schools? One of my doctoral students, Karen Winner, is doing a study in Tanzania. Tanzania is a country that faces the same paradox that many countries that have removed school fees face. As initial enrollment has increased, so have dropout rates. And so she has interviewed students, parents, and teachers about why they drop out. And she has uncovered that there is much physical violence against the kids who need to combine work and study. And when they miss classes a few days, they are caned very severely. So it is no accident that they prefer to drop out of school. Third, based on a good understanding of the relationship of educational institutions to their social context and of their functioning and effectiveness, we need to know the impact of interventions deliberately designed to improve the effectiveness of schools, as well as the intended and unintended impact of policies designed to improve educational opportunity. But this evaluation should not treat schools as black boxes. They really should try to contribute to program theory. Let me give you an example. One of my students has done a mixed method study evaluating the impact of a teacher training program in Ethiopia. And the quantitative piece of his analysis demonstrates this was a program designed to promote student-centered learning. The quantitative evaluation shows that in three subjects, the students whose teachers participated in the training score significantly higher than those who didn't, and that'd be good and fine. But Ben Piper, this is his name, was not content. He actually did a qualitative piece where he looked at three things. He looked at the actual implementation of student-centered pedagogies, and he found, here's the paradox, that the teachers who had received the training were no difference in their propensity to use student-centered pedagogies than those who had. So how do you explain the difference? He then looked at teachers' knowledge and found that those who had been trained were much more knowledgeable about these methods. And then he looked at teacher decision-making. He confronted the teachers with examples of what he had observed them doing, and he asked them, why did you do that? And what he finds is that the training is effective because it makes teachers more knowledgeable, and it gives them the expertise to make fine judgments about when it is most appropriate to use student-centered pedagogies in contexts that have fairly large classes. So his bottom line is very different from what one might have concluded if he had done a black box approach where you could have said, let's get everybody to do student-centered pedagogy. His conclusion is, let's make the teachers more expert so they can decide when to do student-centered learning. I'm just finished. I need one more minute. Another example of importance of uncovering. In many developing countries, inclusion has been achieved by using facilities more intensive, double school shifts. And a few people have examined what does that really mean for learning opportunity. One of my students has just finished a dissertation looking at what happens in double shift schools in Mexico, looking at exactly the same schools, the same catchment areas. And he finds that the kids who are streamed into the afternoon shift are the poorer kids in the same communities, where they are taught by the older teachers in the school, those who are about to retire because the income at retirement is a function of the last year's salary, where they are taught significantly less time than they are in the morning, and where they do not have access to many of the materials physically available in the school to the kids in the morning. So lastly, we need knowledge about the process of change itself and about the role of leadership and professional development in initiating and sustaining change. Educational change to foster inclusion and reduce inequity doesn't follow knowledge of the facts. Programs are designed, implemented, and scaled up because there are leaders who make this happen. If we are to transform educational institutions, we cannot just hope for good leadership, but we need to study it so we can plan it, develop it, and sustain it. We need to know more about the role of leadership in general in initiating educational innovation and reform, from school principals to educational managers and decision makers, as well as leaders of private entrepreneurial approaches or public-private partnerships. This is an area that has been vastly understudied in the developing world. It's a big black hole in our knowledge base. Expanding our knowledge about the role of leadership is central to supporting instructional improvement. The foundations to build relevant competencies that can close equity gaps are the instructional core, the daily interactions among students, teachers, curriculum, and instructional resources. These are also the four principal levers for instructional improvement. But two additional dimensions are time, consistency, and alignment. It takes time to learn and to teach, and in general, the more time students and teachers have available, the more engaged learning time, the more they will learn. But teaching supports the development of children in a developmental continuum, in a trajectory. So it is important that there is consistency in instructional quality throughout the learning trajectories of students. It is of relatively little help to a student to have a great teacher in one subject one time. Alignment is a central concept in understanding the systemic nature of instructional quality. So curriculum, instruction, resources, and assessment should be aligned in a single grade and across grades so that students' educational experiences are coherent, synergistic, and they compound. And the purpose of leadership is to produce that alignment in the schools. To conclude, the knowledge that can help us close equity gaps in education is knowledge that is relevant to clear purposes and that reflects clear thinking about the relationship of educational institutions to social institutions and about the way in which the development of cognitive, emotional, and social competencies allows people to become self-authoring individuals and contributing members of their communities. This knowledge should focus on the broad areas of studying the relationship of educational institutions to their context, studying the functioning of educational institutions, examining the impact of educational programs, and studying the process of educational innovation and change and the role of educational leadership in that process. That knowledge should draw on multiple disciplinary and methodological traditions and provide the foundation for a process of design and implementation of interventions that will go beyond the automatic adaptation of these research findings. There are reasons to be hopeful about the potential of organized efforts to promote education inclusion, for much has been achieved since these relatively recent inventions we call schools became widely available to most of the world's children. Continuing to make progress in generating the knowledge and using what is known to deepen and broaden the development of human talent is one of the most exciting opportunities of our times. Thank you.